Wonderful. Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Joe. She said, "What should I say about you?" I said, "Just say it's one more bozo on the bus." How about that, right? My sobriety date is July the 25th, 1983. Isn't that crazy? I blinked, you know. Was 25 years old, and my life had been a mess. I mean, it had been an extreme mess. I had people, when I came to AA, everybody that was in AA looked 100. They did. Everybody was old. And I remember sitting in my first meeting, looking around the room, thinking if I was old, I would probably smoke cigarettes, drink coffee, and wait till die around an AA meeting. Now I am one. I am one old. But the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says I'm supposed to disclose in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm not going to spend a lot of time explaining to y'all what it's like to be drunk. I think you already know. But I will share with you an interesting tidbit. When I was 14, I would buy beer at a Zippy Market near my house, and it was the cheapest beer that they sold was Busch Bavarian beer. It was $1.35 a six-pack. If you're 67 years old and you remember how much a six-pack of beer was when you were 14, the reason you can is because you're an alcoholic. And I needed beer. I didn't want beer. I needed beer even that early. And there were two ways I could get beer at 14 years old. There was this lady. Look, some of the things I'm going to share with y'all tonight, you are really not going to believe. Just know this, I'm not going to tell you nothing but the truth, right? I don't have any reason to tell you anything else, but some of this is going to be a little uncanny, and there's a reason for it. Because my God is so huge. My God is so huge that He makes these calamities happen in my life. And I've got goosebumps saying that because it is the truth. And this is one of them. When I was 14, if there was a certain lady that was selling beer, I could walk into that Zippy Market and set a six-pack on the counter and hand her $1.35, and she would hand me that six-pack like I was a grown-ass man. The other way I could do it was I could sit in my friend's car or just sit on the side of the building and wait on somebody that was old enough to buy beer. And I would say, "Hey, mister, if you'll buy me a six-pack, I'll give you a beer." And they would do it. In 19, whatever that was, they would do it like it was okay because everybody drank beer. If you drank and wrecked your car drunk, they would say, "Bill got drunk and ran over somebody and killed him, and everybody's mad at him." I mean, you didn't go to jail for drinking. You just didn't. Everybody drank back then, or at least that was my perception, right? But most people would just bring you those beers. Here's the difference between me and my friends. I didn't need five. I needed six. It made me angry to give up a beer because I did not need five beers. I needed six. But I would give up a beer to get the five. That's alcoholism, and I had it young, right? Now, I'm going to fast forward from that Zippy Market. And all of a sudden, I was sober, and I was 26, been sober about a year. I was probably 25 and some change. I had been sober for a little while, and I decided that I wanted to be an addictions counselor. So I started going to workshops for addictions counselors. And I was in this workshop and I looked across the room and was stunned because there was a lady that I knew. And I ran across the room because I was so excited. And I said, "Lady, I'm going to ask you a really squirrely question." And she said, "Yes, dear," and smiled. She was a sweet little woman, right? I said, "Did you ever work at the Zippy Market on Woodley Road in Montgomery, Alabama?" And we were at a conference in Birmingham. And she said, "Yes." And I said, "When you were working the counter, you would sell me beer." And she went, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I owe you an amends." I said, "Sweetie, you don't owe me an amends. You did the most wonderful thing that ever happened for me. You helped me get a drink when I needed one, and you helped me open my doorway to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for that I really believe I will always be grateful, and I still am." Her name was Grace. She died last month. I got goosebumps. That's how my journey has been, and it will be for you. It will be for you if you hang in there. If you don't, it won't. It will not, okay? This is the way my drinking was. I drank alcoholically, and when I would drink, I would create all kinds of problems because I was excited. I was excited all the time. I would get especially excited when I would get drunk, and I would wonder why y'all weren't excited like I was, because I was excited, right? And I would start to drinking, and I'd get so excited, and then everybody around me would be like, "Oh, my God, he's excited." And I moved out of my parents' house. I was 18 years old. I moved in with a car salesman. I'm in the car business, been in the car business since I was all my life. My family's in the car business, third generation. And I moved in with a 40-year-old man, and he was an alcoholic. And I told my mom, I said, "I'm going to move in with Boots." And she said, "Boots is an alcoholic." She said, "I don't think you need to move in with Boots." I said, "He's not drinking. I ain't never seen Boots drink." She said, "Son, he's gonna. Now, let me back up. A few months before I moved in with Boots, I came in drunk from being out all night. And I walked into work and I had the shakes. And Boots said, "Son, why don't you go get a beer?" And I was 18 years old. He said, "Why don't you go get a beer?" I said, "Boots, alcoholics drink in the morning." He looked at me and said, "Son, you're already an alcoholic. Go get you a beer." And he said it just like that. I moved in with Boots. Everything's going good. All of a sudden, I hear Boots in the bathroom in the morning, and I hear this at the same time, right? And then I thought, he's popped a top on a beer. Didn't say anything. He's hiding it, right? I'm drinking wide open. I mean, I'm drinking wide open. He's hiding it from me. He don't want me to know yet. Next thing you know, and now here's how Boots drank. He would squirrel his money back selling cars, and he was a really good car salesman. And he would keep squirreling hundreds back till he had a wad of money like that with a rubber band around it. He would drink water. He would eat bologna sandwiches that he cooked on the stove, right? Because he wasn't going to spend a nickel. He was going to hoard his money, and he was not drinking. Then when he would get a knot, that's what we call that, when he'd get a knot in his pocket, he looked at me and said, "Let's let the good times roll." And that's when me and Boots started drinking together. So we're running between two bars on the Atlanta, on the Troy Highway, the Limit and the Paradise Lounge. We're running between them two bars. They are dirt floor honky tonks. and we had an apartment near there. Fast forward this story, Boots is drinking's completely out of control. I go home about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Boots has lost his job because he's not coming to work no more. And when I get to the apartment, I open the door and flip on the light, and Boots is laying in the floor trying to get a shotgun barrel in his mouth and his toe in the trigger to kill himself, right? So I wrestle the shotgun away from Boots, and I pour him into his bed. I'm 18. And I sit down at the table in the kitchen, and I get me a beer, and I'm drinking a beer. And then it occurs to me what a wonderful person I am, because I've just saved my friend's life. I'm his champion. And my ego gets so excited. I'm his champion. I have saved Boots' life. And then I get to thinking about one of the other things that's been a problem in my life. I get to thinking about this brunette that just moved in upstairs, and I'm so excited when I'm thinking about her, right? And I'm drinking and thinking. And I'm thinking, man, I just saved Boots' life. I sure would like to meet that girl upstairs. And then I think, well, how could I break the ice? How could I just meet her? You know, because I always wanted to meet her, but I never had a chance. So the thought occurs to me, I'm going to take this shotgun, and I'm going to go up to her apartment, and I'm going to say, ma'am, I don't want to bother you, but my friend was about to kill himself, and I just saved his life. Would you mind holding this shotgun? And you are laughing because you are my kind of alcoholic. And I think this is genius. And the more I think about it, the more excited and giddy I get. And I can remember walking up the stairs to the second floor apartment, giggling, this is going to be great. And I'm in and out of a blackout. And the problem with my drinking is when I get drunk, you can't see me. I can see you, but you can't see me because I become invisible. So as I slip up to this apartment, I hear all these voices in the apartment. And they're laughing because they're having a party. They're having a party at this apartment. And then I'm thinking, that plan ain't going to work. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to just kid them. I'm going to swing the door open and go, aha, with my shotgun. And then I'm going to laugh and tell them I was just kidding. And that's what I did. I did. I swung the door open, so help me God. And I said, aha! And two big guys grabbed me and threw me down on the floor. One had the shotgun pointed at me. And I said, listen, I'm so sorry. I was just kidding. I just wanted to meet her, and I pointed at the brunette. That's how my drinking is. So the next morning, 5:30, 5:45, I pop out of bed, petrified. I'm scared to death. I don't remember everything I did, but I vaguely remember going up the stairs with the shotgun and thinking that I had a good idea. Now I cannot wait. I got to go up there now because I'm scared. This is the hideous four horsemen. I am plagued by terror. And I run up those stairs and I knock on that girl's door. And she cracks that door open and sticks that shotgun out that door and said, you take this to your apartment and don't you ever come back to this apartment again. And she slammed the door. And that's when I knew our relationship was over. That is my alcoholism. I'm not going to say any more about it. You know, I don't know what brought you here. You know, we talk about alcohol in here, and I'm not going to take you through all the other things that I did in my life. I will just say this. If you get here and you feel like cocaine is your problem, give yourself a minute, because if you really meditate upon it, you might realize that your cocaine addiction started when you were drunk out of your mind. And anything that you got you here may not be what really got you here. What really got here, you may have been alcohol, because that is what got me here. And I've done a lot of other stuff. All right. So when I got sober, they took me to the treatment program. My sister had been, she was 5 years older than me. She had turned me on to my first joint. We drank together. We were drinking and drugging buddies. She had gotten busted about 2 years before, 4 years before I got sober. And she had gone to the psych unit because they didn't have treatment programs back then. So in 1979, I went to a psych unit because I was loaded out of my mind and it was just a mess, like it always is, right? And I went to the psychiatric unit, and when I got there, I was 20. I had my 21st birthday in the psych unit. And there was a guy that knew my sister. He was 5 years older than me, and he knew my sister. And he was an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic. Everybody else in the psych unit were crazy. We weren't crazy. We were alcoholics. We would talk about the same joints we drank in, the same experiences that we had. We're in a group therapy session one day, and the little therapist looks over at him and says, well, tell me this, how do you feel? And he really thought about that, man. He put his head in his hands, his elbows were on his knees, and he just really contemplated, how do I feel? And he looked up at her and he said, lady, I'll tell you how I feel. I ain't satisfied. I ain't satisfied drunk. I ain't satisfied sober. I ain't satisfied. And he took those words out of my soul. I thought, my God, that's me. That's me. That's why I don't want a drink. I need a drink. Later on, I realized when I was in AA and really got traction, I realized this is what he said. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effects produced by alcohol. While they admit that it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. Their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And it goes on to say that the difference between a regular drinker and an alcoholic is a thing called the phenomenon of craving. And this irritable, restless, and discontented feeling is what my alcoholism is. That is what it is. And the only solution I knew up until I got sober was that a drink would fix it like that. It would fix it like that, right? So that's what I used. It was the only tool I had. If your only tool's a hammer, everything's a nail, right? But when I got here and I started understanding that thing, it made me think back to that psych unit. But I wind up in this treatment program, and I'm looking at all these people thinking, I'm 25. I was built like a pit bull. I thought, But here's what I had a moment of clarity about. Everybody I knew was an alcoholic. Every time I got paid, I was paying off bar tabs at honky-tonks to run another tab to take my paycheck there on Friday or the equivalent at somebody's house, right? Everybody I knew was an alcoholic or a drug addict, and I knew that I was not going to make it. So when they said, these are the steps we took, I took them. I had this huge resentment toward my grandfather because my grandfather would say these hideous things to me. He would say that I was too stupid to work in a pie factory tasting pies. He would say that I was so screwed up I couldn't pat my ass with both hands. And he was old and real tough looking. He was an old car man. And these things damage my self-esteem. So when I started taking my inventory, they said, tell me about who you resent. Well, I resent my grandfather. Why? Because he tells me I'm too stupid to work in a pie factory. Tasting pies. He says that I can't pat my ass with both hands. He's damaged my self-esteem. And when I began taking my inventory, this is the way it was with me and my grandfather. He would be at the car lot and he'd say, go back there. We had a shop that was about 300 yards behind the main office. Go back there and get me a hubcap for the 77 Mustang. I'd say, yes, sir, and I'd walk back there. And I'd be stoned out of my mind because I've been smoking weed all day. And about halfway back there, I would think, what did he want? What the hell did he want? He wanted something. And then I'd go back up there and I'd say, Granddaddy, what was it you wanted? And he would spin around and say, you're too stupid to work in a pie factory tasting pies. And what I had done through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous was I had met the enemy and he was me. Now, I'm just going to take you through this real quick, okay? Alcoholics that come to AA are victims. They're victims. They have been used, abused, and reused by everyone from their wife or husband to their boss to their cousins, aunts, uncles. They have been used and abused by every employer that they have ever had because they have gotten the short end of the stick. They have not been paid their fair share of money, and they are angry about it. Victims don't recover. Victims don't recover. So when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm thinking about, you know what, my dad, man, he's been in the car business all his life and he's got guys that are my age, they're 25 years old and they're driving new cars, they got the good looking honeys in their car with them. And my dad really respects them and they are his friends. And I'm eat up with resentment. Why does he like them? And he don't like me. Why does my daddy like these people that he works with? They're my age. I don't even understand how he can like them. And they got the fancy cars with the hot chicks. And then I'm asked this question. Let me ask you this. Those guys that work with your dad, what have they been doing for the last 5 years? I said, hell, they've been selling cars and working every day. What have you been doing? I said, I've been trying to figure out where to score. I've been drinking. I've been living in a honky-tonk. Maybe that's why you're unsuccessful is because you haven't done anything to be successful. So all of a sudden I get this clue, I have met the enemy and he is me. The resentment that I have toward them is not my problem. My problem is that I'm an undisciplined alcoholic who don't have no ability to figure out how to swim. And I used the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to begin to get some traction. I started making amends. I started praying and meditating. And then I started working with other people. I've done a lot of things that ain't right in my sobriety. But here's what I have done that has kept me sober, and this is the antidote, and I'm going to tell you the answer to Alcoholics Anonymous and how to stay sober. The problem with alcoholism is it turned me into a victim. Everybody else was my problem. When I worked through the steps and I realized that they are not the problem, I'm the problem, then I began to build a relationship with a higher power and I began to clean up my past. But here's the real trick. I thought when I got to AA, alcohol was my problem. I really believed all the way to my tippy toes my problem was my drinking, because to anybody that looked at my life, they would say his problem is he's drunk all the time. But that was not my problem. My problem is selfishness, self-centeredness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And those things controlled me. Now, if my problem is truly selfishness, self-centeredness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, I've got to have a solution to that. And the problem that makes me that way is my eyeballs turn inward and all I can think about is me. I can't think about anything but me. And so what I have to have is I have to have a step that lets me in the evening think about my day. Where have I been selfish or self-centered? Whom have I hurt? Who do I owe an amends? And I have to do it on a daily basis or I will drift. Now, I'm not sitting here standing before you telling you that I have not drifted. I have drifted. You can look at me and tell I have been distracted. But here's what I have done. Every time an alcoholic would reach out his hand and ask me to help him, I would meet him and I will go through the book with him and I will go through the steps with him. My sponsor has 8 years of sobriety. And he has 8 years of sobriety because he has what I want. And let me tell you what my sponsor, Todd, has. My sponsor has this lineage of people that he sponsored that has just grown around him. He's 8 years sober, and I've known him for several years. And I've outlived three sponsors that were my deepest, closest sponsors, and I will tell you about them. But I do want to tell you this about Todd before I get into what sponsorship is about and how really important it is. And this will be part of it too. Todd carries people through the steps in 2 weeks. And so I've been sober all these years. And I've sat down and tried to do with people what was done with me. I sit down and get in the book with them, and I kind of watch them, and I try to help them get through the book. And there hasn't been a lot of success with that. And I look at Todd, and he's got all these people around him, and he's getting them through the steps in 2 weeks. And I said, tell me about that. Well, he said, this is what I do. So I'm just going to share it with you, and I'm going to share it with you quickly. He said, I sit down with them and forget the book. They're too high to understand the book. Pick out some pieces of that book that are important. Explain it to them so that they get a little bit of a clue, but get them to understand they're powerless, their lives become unmanageable, they have come to believe that a power greater than themselves can restore them to sanity. Get on your knees and be with them when they make a decision to turn their will and life over to the care of God as you understand them, and then give them a piece of paper and tell them to write down everybody that they resent and every principal, person, or institution with whom they are angry. He said, here's why. Because it says the alcoholic in just a short amount of time can't even remember the major problems that he had just recently. And if they don't get this, they're not going to have any relief and they're not going to make it. So I started doing what Todd taught me. And I started meeting with people going through that. I will meet with them on the first day, and I will make sure that they have a clear understanding of the first and second steps. I will go through the book with them just enough to know that they get it. I will tell them that what I want them to do is study these pages, and I want you to write down everybody you resent. And I'll meet with them again, and we'll go over that, and we'll sit down, and we'll do the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th steps right then. And then I send them off to make amends. And then when they get done making amends and they can share some of that experience, then I will sit down with them and I'll go through 10, 11, and 12. And they're on. Now, that may sound crazy to you, but I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 41 years. It makes more sense than anything I've ever done. And here's why. They got to have some relief, and they're going to get the relief from doing the work. And then once they do the work, they'll understand the book. That's just my experience. Now, let me share with y'all how important sponsorship is. I don't know what time it is, and I don't want to run over. Okay, well, let me know when I get close. Just give me 5 minutes, okay? Just let me know, okay? Here's what sponsors have meant to me. One of the greatest sponsors I ever had was Don T. I was 47 years old, and I wanted to go out with a girl that was in AA about 3 months. I'd been sober for years. And I said, Don, there's this girl that's got 3 months of sobriety, and I really want to ask her out. He said, Joe, you better get her before God does, because if God gets her, she won't have nothing to do with you. Don would say, Joe, you need to always remember this. A man will only have two problems in his whole life, pink or green. And when you call me up on the telephone, I'm going to ask you the first question. I'm going to say, Joe, is it pink or green? Now, if you don't understand that, see me after the meeting. Because it worked for me, and I never failed to have an answer for that. Don T. would look at me and say, I'd be having marriage problems. I've had some marriage problems. I'm not going to tell y'all all about them. You'll be judging me. And I tell you why you'll be judging me. Listen to me now. I'm going to give you some good information. You might not hear some of it. You'll be judging me because that's what alcoholics do. That's what alcoholics do. They sit in an AA meeting and they judge everybody around them. They don't like this son of a bitch over here because of this. They don't like that son of a bitch over there because of that. They ain't going to talk to him because of this. They ain't going to talk to her about that. And I damn sure ain't going to trust that one right there. They ain't never read in the book where it says the inventory was ours. They ain't never read that. They can't read that because they're too busy taking your inventory. Don was wonderful. Don would say, Joe, the secret to a good marriage is 2 TVs and an 8 o'clock AA meeting. 2 TVs and an 8 o'clock AA meeting. Secret to a good marriage. Don't forget that. I had a friend who Don was sponsoring him at the same time he was me. And he had done took him a hostage, right? He had him a little hostage over at his house. He was real excited about her right up till she started having opinions. So he called Don up and said, let me tell you what the bitch did. And Don listened to him. The next night, he called Don and said, let me tell you what the bitch did this time. Don listened to him. The third night, he said, Don, you ain't going to believe what the bitch did. Don said, let me ask you something, Ori. Have you got a pistol? He said, yes. He said, take that pistol in there and shoot that bitch in the head. Ori said, Don, I can't shoot her. He said, then I reckon you're going to have to accept her, ain't you? Now, let me tell you something. That's good sponsorship. That's the way sponsorship should be done. You understand? I'm in an AA meeting with Don one night. He'd chair meetings. And as long as I knew Don, and he sponsored me, which was 20 years. And when I tell you I love Don, I cannot get across to you how much I loved him, right? We're sitting in AA meeting. He only had one topic. He would say, has anybody got a topic they'd like to talk about? And this guy said, yes, sir, I was beating my wife in the front yard before I come to the meeting tonight. You cannot make this shit up, right? He said, I was beating my wife in the front yard before I come over here. This is what Don said. That's a good topic, step two. Now that's funny. If you ain't laughing at that, you don't get the step. Step two. Another night I'm over there, and this guy raises his hand and says, I'd like to tell y'all that I have let y'all down. I drank. Don said, you don't surprise us when you drink. You surprise us when you don't drink. That's who Don was. You understand? I got the call one day that Don had bone cancer. And they said, Don's got bone cancer. I knew it was a death sentence as soon as they told me. You don't recover from it. I knew it was a death sentence. So I started going by his house every Sunday just to spend a little time with him till the chemo got so bad I couldn't go over there because it just was awful. But then somewhere in there, he had a heart attack. He's dying of bone cancer, and he had a heart attack, and I'm just devastated. I run up to the hospital to see him. I said, Don, I can't believe you had a heart attack. He looked at me and said, God throwed me a curve. God throwed me a curve. And he had the best attitude. Do you understand what I'm saying? He had a cool attitude. Nothing bothered him. And he'd say, everybody's praying for me. It ain't going to help them. It ain't going to help me, but it'll help them. They all praying for me. It ain't going to help me, but it'll help them. A guy called him up and said, Don, I'm going to kill myself. I was at Don's house. He said, what? You're going to kill yourself? He said, yes, sir, I'm going to kill myself. Don said, if you ain't done it by 8 o'clock, I'll see you at the meeting. Hung the phone up. You ain't done it by 8 o'clock, I'll see you at the meeting. That's good sponsorship. I don't care who you are, that's good sponsorship. They asked me and Don to speak at the first anniversary of the happy hour. That's my home group. And I thought, man, I can't. He was dying of cancer. I thought, God, I can't speak behind him. You know, I didn't even know who they were going to have speak first, but luckily they had me speak first. And I got all this bullshit out of the way where he could give a real AA talk. And this is what he said when he walked up to the podium. He said, I want to tell everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous how grateful I am for Alcoholics Anonymous. It allowed me to live long enough to get cancer. Where do you get that? That's all I can tell you about Don, but he died, and I thought, who am I going to get to sponsor me? Oh, let me back up. He was dying of cancer. He was in the hospital for that heart thing. The other guy who he was sponsoring that had the hostage that he told to kill. You can't make this up. He called me up and he said, I went up to the hospital to see Don. I said, how was he? He said, man, he ain't good. He said, I asked him who I needed to get to be a sponsor when he died. I said, you did not. I said, you did not ask him that. He said, yeah, I did. I said, what did you say? Because I needed to know too, right? You can't make this up, right? You know, somebody told me when I got up here that laugh. You said you'd laugh. I said, let me tell you something. The only way you'll laugh is if I'm telling the truth. That's why y'all are laughing, because I'm telling the truth. If you tell the truth, look, next time you go to speak at AA meeting, tell the truth, they'll laugh. Just remember that. So anyway, I said, what did he say? Do you want to hear how sharp that guy was? When he's asked, who am I going to get to be my sponsor when you're dead? Here's Don's response. Or you don't need a sponsor today. You work a one day at a time program and I ain't dead. Now let me tell y'all something. When he left, and I got goosebumps all over me. When he left this world, it left a hole in my heart that will never be filled. But I was stuck with having to figure out who's going to be my sponsor. Because listen to me, the steps are great. You got to have the steps. If you don't do step one, you will drink. You can only do step one and not drink. As a matter of fact, if you don't do step one, you will drink. But if you just do step one, you don't even have to worry about the rest of the steps because you ain't even got to work them. Because they're going to work you. You ain't going to have no choice about whether or not. If you really do step one, you ain't going to have no choice about whether you're going to do everything in them steps. Because you're going to. It's the only way you're not going to drink. So now I got to get me another sponsor, so I go to Ben. Ben's 100 years old, too. Ben knows me, and he don't want to sponsor me because he knows I'm wild as the West Texas wind. And he said, Joe, I just don't know whether we'd be a good fit. I said, Ben, I'm only going to call you for one or two reasons. If I'm going to kill somebody or I'm going to kill myself, that's the only time I'm going to call you. I said, I'm easy. So Ben was working with me. And God, I love Ben. But I was thinking the whole time, man, if I ever really need Ben, he ain't going to have the wisdom that Don had. No way. He'll never be the sponsor for me that Don was. And then one day I'm going to my dad, with my dad to the doctor, taking him to the doctor because he has a bunch of tests because he's dying. I didn't know he was dying. But we get to the doctor, and he said, you got ALS, you're terminal. And when he tells my dad that, I looked at the doctor, and I said, how long has he got to live? Now, that's how selfish I am. I suffer from alcoholism. My eyeballs are turned inward. The only thing I think about is myself. I have to work with other people because the book doesn't say you were selfish. I'm just going to tell you. It says that you're selfish, and it doesn't say that you, in the event that you might have to make an amends, it says when you make amends. Not if, right? Just a heads up. And the doctor looked at my dad and said, do you want to know? And he said, yes. And the doctor said, yes, sir. Oh, give me a hug. Thank you. Oh, see, now there's a guy that's working on his selfishness. He brought me a, he thought about me. You're wonderful. Thank you. He looked at my dad and said, 6 months. I ran out the door, picked up the telephone, and I called my sponsor, Ben, who ain't never going to know what to tell me. And this is what Ben said. I said, Ben, my dad's terminally dying. He said, sport, if things go well, you outlive your dad. Sport, if things go well, you outlive your dad. He told me it was okay for me to let go of my dad. All right, I'm going to wrap this thing up, okay? With two things, three things. I buried my sister in AA. I buried my mama in AA. I was with them holding both their hands when they drew their last breath. And here's what the book says. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he would surely drink again. He would not be able to meet the certain trials and tribulations that are to come. Now, that's awful little, but it's close. These are the trials and tribulations. You're going to lose people that you love, and it's going to break your heart, and there ain't going to be a step to fix it. But you're going to be good with it. You're going to be okay. You know, I thought when I first got here, if my mom died, I'd never make it. And my mom died. I buried her. We had the greatest funeral for her that I've ever been to in my life, and everybody that was there said that was not a funeral. That was an event. It was cool, man. All right. I'm in Pensacola, Florida, camping with two females. And a guy pulls in an orange microbus, Volkswagen, about 11 o'clock at night, drunk out of his mind, and he comes running over to the picnic table where me and these two girls are hanging out. And he's excited because he likes girls. And I said, hey, look, cowboy, you drunk. Just spin around, go on over there and pass out in your van. We don't want you over here. He looked like I'd punched him in the nose. He passed out. The next morning, he gets up. His eyes look like a Georgia road map. And he sees us again, and he sees these two girls, and he's so excited, and he runs back over there. And I said, hold on just a minute, cowboy. Let me tell you what you did last night. You come over here drunk out of your mind, and you wagged your weenie at these two girls right here. And he went, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. And he started to run back to his van. I busted out laughing. I said, I'm just kidding. Come here. I said, I'm just kidding. I said, you were good. I was just kidding. So we get to cutting up with him. He said, would you go fishing with me? And I said, yeah. I'm thinking I'd rather take an ass whooping than go fishing with you. And he drags this big old cooler down to the beach, and he starts fishing. And he's drinking, and it's early, and he says, have a beer with me. And I said, nah, I appreciate it. He said, please have a beer with me. Maury Cast, he didn't want me to have a beer with him. He needed me to have a beer with him, right? Finally, he said, please have a beer with me. And I said, I'm not going to have a beer with you. You know why I'm not? He said, why? And I said, because I've been sober and Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time for 17 years. And he looked like I punched him in the face. And I said, you know why I quit drinking? And he said, why? I said, I got tired of waking up in the morning not remembering what I did. And he looked at me and said, I was in AA once for 2 years. And I looked at him and I said, we need you. I said, there's only one soul in the whole universe that's going to be able to help the guy who's going to walk into AA that's going to need you. You're the only soul in the whole world that can touch him. When he gets there, I hope you're there. And I hugged him tight. And I left. 6 months later, a friend of mine who had been, hopeless, bounce in and out of treatment centers and jails, was in a halfway house in Jackson, Mississippi, and came home for the weekend, and he walked into my office, and he said, Hollywood, let me ask you something. I said, yeah. He said, I'm here on pass from the treatment program over in Jackson, Mississippi. I said, well, good for you, William. I'm excited for you. He said, I was telling everybody over there I was coming home for my first pass, and there was a guy in there that said, where's home? And he said, I said, Montgomery, Alabama. He said, you know Hollywood? He said, oh, yeah, I know Hollywood. Hollywood was my counselor when I was in treatment one time, and he's my brother's sponsor. He said, tell Hollywood the guy he went fishing with at Fort Pickens has got 6 months of sobriety. It's a cool story, ain't it? All right, let me fast forward you to this, and then I swear to God I'm going to shut up. I got a doctor friend. Now, that don't even sound right. I've got a doctor friend. This guy's been my friend for 35 years. He lived in Rapid City, South Dakota, and every time I'd go to Sturgis, South Dakota, I would stay with Will. He was from Montgomery, moved to Rapid City because he liked Bike Week. He's a brush pilot and an avid camper. And I called him up because I was having a physical problem and I wanted to ask his opinion of it. And he said, Hollywood, hold on just a minute. Let me put you on speaker. You got to hear this. He said, man, the other day me and Vida was flying and we were flying out in Wyoming and we landed on a grass strip in the middle of nowhere. We tied the airplane down and we hiked for 40 miles. He said, we spent the night, we hiked into 40 more miles into the most beautiful wilderness God ever created. And we're sitting out there and he said, Hollywood, you're not even going to believe this. He said, we're sitting out there, and all of a sudden, a dog comes out of nowhere. And I said, hey, buddy, and I'm petting this beautiful dog, man. And he said, all of a sudden, two guys come out of the brush. And one of them looked at me and said, where are you from? He said, Montgomery, Alabama. He said, do you know Hollywood? Will said, oh, yeah, I know Hollywood. He stays at my house every Sturgis. He said, would you tell him that the guy he went fishing with at Fort Pickens got 10 years? If you need Will Waller's telephone number, Dr. Will Waller, I have it in my phone back there, and I will put his ass on the telephone with you if you don't believe that. Because if I were you, I wouldn't. That's how big my God is. And if my God is big enough to make the miracles happen that he has made happen in my life, he is big enough for yours. Thank you.